Okay, I thought what we could do here is we'll do just 10 minutes or so of a little bit of some more genetic science, just to get familiar with a few terms. We'll then show the clip we saw yesterday one more time, for those of you who haven't seen it. Then we'll dive into a case study and guided conversation. Yeah?
Just starting, would you review gene, DNA, and chromosome for me?
Okay, well, we've got a few of these up here. Well, let me back up then for that part of it. Then the gene, we back up here just a little bit here, that we've got literally trillions of cells in our body, and every single one of those cells has a nucleus within it. And within that nucleus is where we find the chromosomes. And the chromosomes are simply units that contain strands of the DNA, the diribonucleic acid, which is in the form of this double helix and is made up of these subunits of four chemicals, A, T, C, and G. That's
it. Can a chromosome have multiple DNA in it?
Yeah, has a number of genes. In every chromosome, there are many genes. And so, for example, if we move forward here, chromosome 4. Now, remember that I told you that all of us have two copies of every gene. Well, that means that we basically have two copies of every chromosome. In the sex, in terms of the last one here, females have two X's and males have an X and a Y. So it's a little different at the very end here on what would be our 23rd chromosome. But for all of the rest, they're called autosomal chromosomes here. You have two copies of every chromosome. So here's chromosome 4. You have one copy from your father, one copy from your mother. And along the arms and legs of this little piece of material are the sequences, the genetic sequences. And there are 30,000 of these genes. And a gene, then, is a distinct sequence that codes for a particular protein and therefore function within the body. So that's what it is. So we have a gene for our eye color, for example. I'm going to in a minute show you how heterozygous and homozygous and dominant recessive work using blood. We all have a genetic sequence for the type of blood that we have, A, B, and O. How many of you know your blood type? Does everyone know their blood type?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, do you know what blood type means? So that's what we'll tell you to me, what that is, how that means. So we have two copies of each chromosome, and therefore every gene in our body. Okay? Another term that I want to make sure you understand is allele. Is the term allele? Allele simply means a variation of a particular gene.
Blue-eyed, green-eyed.
A, A, B, O. And I'll explain how you can have A, B as well as A and B and O. Okay, so, yeah.
I have a couple of questions. If we have 30,000 genes, do you know how many genes a chimpanzee has?
Pretty darn close.
Close?
Yeah. My biology professor likes to sometimes make little digs, you know, saying that there's a sense in which there's more variation across human populations in some areas of the genome than there is across the non-human primate and the human. So very, very close in terms of the genetic code.
Yeah. Another question. Is genetics able to show that we come from a common ancestor to both human and chimpanzee?
Well, along with other kinds of, it depends. Okay, again, now we begin, as soon as you say that, my mind starts to play the chess game and ends up thinking in different ways of answering that question, depending on what you mean by it. If you mean by that evolutionary biology, then yes, it shows pretty clearly that we get that there's speciation and so on and so forth, and that we come from a common ancestor, yeah, through genes. But when we say we, right, what do we mean by we, right? And that's where the discussion comes in about, you know, what might be the distinctive characteristics of human primates as opposed to non-human primates. And this gets back, I often talk about Immanuel Kant in a certain way. He had this notion, which is useful to me, that we simply, our experiences, that we simply live in a world in which we perceive ourselves simultaneously as objects in the world. We can be crushed as easily as an ant, and there's no guarantee that despite us being people of faith that we're not going to get cancer or something like this. You know, I was a chaplain for a year in a cancer unit at Yale New Haven Hospital. And to be blunt with you, you know, as chaplains, we always sort of said, oh no, when we had certain kinds of pastors come into the hospital telling the cancer patients if they just had enough faith, they could somehow overcome the cancer and so on to protect. Then they go away, and in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're trying to help calm down the people who have this notion, because what you end up doing is not only having the cancer, but then having another disease called feeling guilty for having cancer and not having the will and the strength and the faith to overcome it somehow. And it's a mess. You know, it's kind of a mess there that way. So we're objects in the world. Things happen to us just like they happen to anything else. You drop a rock out of a plane or a human being out of a plane, they're going to fall to the ground and it's going to splatter, right? It's going to hit. However, we are also, this is what Kant would put it, we're also perspectives on the world. And that to me is a very powerful concept. It's as though to be a human being is to be outside the universe somehow, being able to look at it. It's almost as though we have an intuition of what it means to be God in that sense, and to see God in each other just from this one point about being a perspective on something. We are in the universe, and yet we seem to be able to be transcended by having a perspective on it. And so, therefore, when you ask the question, or we said, I immediately begin to think, as objects in the world, we certainly have this. This is who we are. We're human primates, in that sense, as opposed to non-human primates. Having a perspective on the world may be a completely different discussion. So, but again, if we go down that path, we have a slightly different course. I don't want to go too far down. Right now, I just want to get through the science a little bit. So we have two copies of every chromosome. And then I mentioned that we have alleles. That means versions. So, for example, your father may give you a gene that codes for A-type blood. And your mother will have the same gene for coding for blood, but it may have a very small variation that leads it to be described as O, say type O blood. So now you have two chromosomes. Both of them have a gene for blood type. Your father gives you one allele, variation of that gene. Your mother gives you another allele, a slightly different variation. So now you have A and O in every cell of your body, a gene for A and O blood. Now, okay, then we'll introduce the concept here then heterozygous and homozygous first. If you have the same allele from your father and your mother, you're said to be homozygous for that gene. Homozygous for that gene, that allele. You have two identical copies, AA. If you then have an A, your father is A and your mother is type O, you're said to be heterozygous. You have one copy of the gene that has one allele, that's one variation. You have another copy, that's a different allele, right? So then what happens when you have a heterozygous When you're heterozygous for a particular gene like blood, what happens? That then introduces the concept of dominant and recessive. Right? Dominant means that all it takes is one copy of the allele to express itself in the form and function of your body. So if your father gives you an A, you're going to have A in your blood type. And it's going to dominate, in the sense, it's going to dominate, in this case, O, the O. And in the case of blood, if you think of it this way, analogy that my biology colleague talks to me about is, think about it as a cookie recipe. You got oatmeal cookies. So blood is like an oatmeal recipe, right? But you can either have raisins or chocolate chips or nothing. Just oatmeal, raisins, chocolate chips. If you think of it that way. And it's really fairly, good analogy because A and B code for different shaped sugar molecules on the blood cell. That's all it means, is there's different shapes. You can think of them as squares and triangles, something of that sort. Or raisins and chocolate chips, right? O means there's nothing there. It basically means that somehow, when you're typing on your keyboard and all of a sudden you look up and you see nothing, gibberish, it all is sort of, it's when you shift your fingers over just one key and there's no recipe there. There's nothing there. You thought you were doing your recipe, nothing there. Type O blood is like that. And whenever you have type A or type B and type O, you will have type A or type B blood. So if your mother gives you an O, your father gives you an A, you will be type A. You'll have blood that's type A. Now, let me throw one more thing in there. We also have a type called AB, right? And I told you that A is dominant, so is B. So that means if you're in the circumstance when your father gives you an A and your mother gives you a B, you're going to have type AB blood. In other words, both alleles are going to express themselves in the shape of the molecule. Right? So that's what that means. So dominant means that it takes only one copy. Recessive means you need both of these. You need both of them to be able to express the genetic code for some function in the body. In this case, blood type. Okay? You need both of them, recessive. Okay? O doesn't cut it. Now, it's interesting that Peruvian Indians, by the way, are 100% O. There's no A, B, or AB amongst Peruvian Indians. And different groups, depending on where you are from, have different percentages of A, AB, and obviously intermarrying is going to change all of that as well. So, and I said before too that chromosomes for various kinds of diseases are genes that, when they go wrong, create the conditions for genetic disease are located on various chromosomes. 4 happens to be Huntington's disease, 7 cystic fibrosis. Breast cancer 17 and 14, diabetes I believe is 11, and so on. That for genetically induced diabetes. Okay, are we there? Do you have questions about what I've said so far? If you don't, then we will be able to go through these slides pretty quickly here. These terms. So, allele is a variation on a gene, and a gene is simply a sequence of DNA that when the RNA splits off, creates a blueprint, creates the amino acids in a particular sequence. It then produces a protein that has a specific function. For example, I used the example yesterday of the chemical in our saliva that begins the process of digestion. All of the cells have all of the DNA in them, but they only express, they fold it over on themselves and shut all of the other genes off and only express the gene for creating that stuff that begins the process of digestion. Homozygous, then, what's homozygous mean? Let's do a quick little testing. So what's homozygous mean?
Both alleles in the two sets of chromosomes are the same.
Exactly. Heterozygous?
They're different.
They're different. Great. Dominant? You only need one copy of a gene for it to express itself, whatever the other one is. Okay. Recessive. You need two. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm still confused about the gene is part of the DNA strand? I mean, the DNA strand goes on for like...
DNA is about 2 meters long. It's a huge molecule, if you want to think of it that way. It's huge. And on that huge molecule, there are 30,000 distinct sequences that have a beginning and an end that when that sequence has a code to create a specific protein that then gives us our form and function for all the parts of our body. Our eyes are different than our ears, our bones different than our... You want to continue? You have a more question?
So you're saying the DNA is made up of a bunch of genes strung together?
That's right. And 30,000, but there's many more. There's much of the sequence are not what we think of as genes. That they don't produce proteins. They used to be called junk DNA, but it turns out that we think that these other sequences have regulatory functions. That is to say, somehow they help control what gets turned on and off, and what combinations will need to happen for something to be expressed, and so on. So it's probably not junk. Probably not junk.
So do the DNA strands make up chromosomes?
So then this long piece, two-meter stuff, then is chopped up into these chromosomes. Right, so the chromosomes, if you were to extend the whole thing...
So the hierarchy is DNA, chromosome, genes?
Well, let's just go back to see the picture. It's a picture here. The hierarchy is like this. This is the strand of DNA, right? These strands of DNA lie along, you can see it, come squiggly there, lie along the arms and legs of the chromosome. Right? And you've got 23 of those, right? Or copies of them, 46, right? Because you have two of each, right? Those are all embedded in the nucleus of the cell. Are we on track?
But the entire strand is reproduced on every chromosome?
No.
Oh.
The entire strand is within the nucleus of the cell. The DNA... it says 2 meters long. That is, if you stretched it all out and combined all of the DNA and the chromosomes, you end up with something like... So the genome, then, is all of the specific genes that make up the content of the nucleus of the cell, of each of our cells. There's trillions of them. They all have the same... Okay? Are we on track here? This is taking longer than I... What? But we'll do it. So just real quick then to understand about the if your father, let's just say this is your, I just did this real quickly this morning to try and make this illustrate. You have different possible alleles for the recipe for blood cells, right? A, B, and O. Father, mother, right? So you have AA, AB, AO, and so on down the line. You have father and mother type A. Guess what the kid's going to be?
A.
Right. AB?
AB.
AB, why?
Because they're both
codominant. A and B are codominant. See, he's taking some science classes, so I'm trying to just hit you with my laser. But AB, yeah, they're codominant, so they're both going to be expressed. You're going to have raisins and chocolate chips on your oatmeal cookies. AO is going to be what?
A.
B, again, same down here all the way through. And the only, in this whole square then, where you're going to have O type O blood, are when both your parents then have type O blood. How many of you are type O? It's surprising that there's that many to me.
Yeah. Oh, that's top of the line.
There's more O's than anything else.
Yeah.
So what happens if one of your parents is AB and the other one is
Well, they in terms of the germ line, there's only 23 chromosomes. So what happens is that, and this is the trick, you never know which allele your parent is going to give you. They never know that. So each time you conceive, you have a different set.
Right?
Pardon?
You have a 1 in 4 chance of being A or AB or B.
Right, yeah. Okay, so now, just to apply this quickly to diseases and so on here, let's take a look at this. Now, I'm real simplistic here, so they have usually use different terms here, but I have good and bad. You have a good allele that does good stuff and a bad allele where you can have problems. So
if the male is the bad one.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Oh, you noticed that? Yeah, I could change that. So so again, good, bad. Now, if it turns out that the gene the bad gene here is dominant, what's going to happen? Half the children will have whatever the disease is that this bad gene is coding for. So let's use Huntington's as an example. The Huntington allele is dominant. All it takes is one set, all you need is one gene, not two. It's dominant. So that's what this would be the case. If you had a male who has the Huntington's allele, there's a 50% chance that any of the children that he participates in conceiving is going to have that allele and will 100% express the disease, usually in their 40s or 50s. So that's what's insidious about this, is that this all comes usually after the reproductive years. So you don't know whether you have it or not until it's often too late in terms of any decision making you might want to make about reproduction associated with it. Okay. Now, let's see. Let me back up here. Yeah. So now let's say it's that this is recessive, that this is a recessive gene here. What's the situation now? That is,
they will be carriers for it, but it won't be expressed in them themselves.
So we have a new term. It's called carrier. So in the case of sickle cell anemia, let's use that as an example. There's the allele for sickle cell. The male, does he have the disease?
No.
No, he doesn't have the disease. He carries the gene for it. And there's a 50% chance that his kids are going to be carriers. Is there any chance that a male with the sickle cell anemia allele conceiving with a woman who doesn't have it, that their kids would have sickle cell anemia?
No.
0% chance they'll be carriers. By the way, interesting note here, you think about it as a sort of an African disease, as well as Mediterranean, by the way. So it seems to be associated with, guess what? Malaria.
Malaria.
All right. Why, do you think?
It's harder for the parasitic malaria to attach to the sickle cell blood cells.
Okay. This guy's had some science this really day. That's exactly
liberal
right.
Arts education.
A very simple way of putting it is that being a carrier provides you with a little bit more protection against malaria than not having it. So there's some advantage to being a carrier if you live in a place where there's malaria. The problem comes here, right? The problem comes here. Protection against malaria. Very nice. You might lose that protection by passing on, in this case, not so, we're already kind of messing up our terms, good, right, gene. You might be a carrier here in this case. You might be a carrier in this case. Unfortunately, there's a 1 in 4 chance that this one and this one will be what's passed on. And guess what this is called? Sickle cell anemia. And what it happens is that the protein, just literally that picture I showed you before, shows protein is misshapen. It creates blood cells that, instead of shaped like sort of a circle with a little kind of indentation in it, they curl in on themselves and they look like a sickle. They're curved, and the problem is they have to, blood cells have to go into capillaries, very small spaces in your body. They get blocked up in there and they end up causing terrible hematomas. They blood a very painful disease and often fatal. And that's because of the shape of the blood cell. That happens when you have two of these alleles. It's a recessive trait, so therefore you're not going to get this unless you get both. is it pretty clear, the science part here? Okay, I'm sorry to take so much time, but I did want to do this. So let's then quickly look at the clip one more time real quickly, then I'll give you the case study, and we'll, because there are new people here, right? Is there anyone here who's new? Yes. Oh, yeah, there's a number of you. So I'll just let you have the transcript while we play this. And this is from the film called Gattaca, for those who are new. We're just going to look at it quickly, and then I'm going to pass out the case study, and the rest of the time we'll spend talking about it. So here's the clip.
I was conceived in the Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. I used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years. The name of the certificate?
Anton?
No, Vincent Anton.
From an early age, I came to think of myself as others thought of me, chronically ill. Every skinned knee and runny nose was treated as if it were life-threatening.
I'm sorry, the insurance won't cover it. If he fell...
But I was told that everything was...
I really wish there was something I could do.
Like most other parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, Marie, have been fertilized with Antonio's sperm. After screening, they're left, as you see, with two healthy boys and two very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First, we may as well decide on gender. Have you given it any thought?
We would want Vincent to have a brother, you know, play with.
Of course you would. Hello, Vincent. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, fairs. Yeah. I have taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions, premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, addictive susceptibility, domestic violence, obesity.
We didn't want, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. The child isn't needing additional burdens. And keep in mind, the child is still you. Simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
It's interesting, it'd be interesting to hear those. This is the second time you've seen it. Well, what you saw the second time around in this clip. I will resist the temptation to talk about the clip again. And we'll just go to this case. This is a case study. It's not a case study. It's a scenario, it's a thought experiment, but it's not so distant future, it's plausible. And as I say, it's called Gen Life Insurance Company. And we still do get calls at the Institute for the phone number of this company, by the way. It doesn't exist. So what I want to do is just quickly read through here, and there's some questions on the back, and I'm going to have you just talk a little bit in some small groups, and we'll discuss. George and Melinda live in Beaverton, Oregon, year 2032. They decided they want to have a child. Melinda has health benefits, Portland State. They examine their policy. Here's what they find. GenLife's committed to quality health care at an affordable price. We want a healthy child. You want a healthy child. We want to help you achieve your goal. Now, we're going to cover 100% of your prenatal and birthing costs, provided you meet the following conditions. You agree that your embryo or fetus will be screened for all known genetic disorders, defects, and disabilities. We will do this either in utero or through in vitro fertilization, our much preferred method. All costs associated will be assumed by GenLife. The screening reveals genetic markers, raising the probability that your child, if you brought the embryo to term, would develop a genetic disorder or disability. You'll have a couple of options. Discard the embryo and repeat the process. GenLife will cover the cost of discarding the embryo fetus and will work with you as many times as necessary to produce an embryo, free of potentially costly genetic anomalies which would pose a threat to your future child's health and greatly increase health care costs. Okay. Keep the embryo and assume full financial responsibility for the treatment of the discovered condition should it or they develop. GenLife will not cover prenatal or birthing costs should you elect to carry an unscreened embryo to term. GenLife will offer health insurance for your unscreened child, but at a cost commensurate with the increased risk associated with unscreened embryos. Be aware that your unscreened child will always be a member of a high-risk pool and will be required to pay higher premiums. Also be aware that if you choose to carry an embryo to term with a known risk or a disorder, or disability, they will never be covered for that disability or disorder by GenLife. This procedure is not mandatory. If you elect not to have your embryo or fetus tested, we will cover your child once born, but the premiums will be commensurate with his or her unscreened risk pool, which is significantly higher than for screened pools. Then there's a couple of versions here. You can, that's the fetal selection program. Under the GFSP program, we'll help you produce 20 embryos through IVF. As with the standard screening program, these embryos will be carefully screened for genetic disorders. In addition, we will test for all known genetically influenced traits, such as sex, height, skin, hair, eye color, etc. We will then assist you in selecting not only the healthiest, but also the most desirable based on your own needs. We understand that you want to give your child every possible advantage. We're here to help, $40,000. So, for example, the HGH, right, the human growth hormone. Maybe you got a deficit there, and maybe it'll be able to make sure that you got enough HGH so you have what you might imagine to be an advantage by being taller, right? Whatever it might be. Then the last one, under the last one here, of enhanced program, GFEP program, you'll not only receive the benefits of standard screening, fetal selection, you'll also be able to take advantage of the latest developments in germline intervention. This technology uses artificial chromosome technology to actually tailor the genetic profile of your child. There are currently 6 known alterations known to be safe and effective. Many others are being developed. Imagine, with our current technology, you have the ability to virtually guarantee a healthy baby with traits known to be advantageous in today's competitive world. Our extensive research shows that your child's genetic profile is the single most important factor for health, longevity, and quality of life. We are so confident that you will be pleased with the results that we will reduce the standard screened embryo premium by half and guarantee these rates for the life of your child. Expensive, yes, but how much is your child's health worth? Questions. You're Melinda and George. Describe your initial reaction to GenLife's team. As you do this, try to analyze the reasons and that you give in defense of your reaction. Having a reaction isn't the same thing as having a moral judgment, by the way. Medical insurance, you can have this, what I call a psychological aversion to something, a kind of yuck response. And needs to be analyzed to see if that is actually leading you in the direction of a defensible moral judgment, right? So it's not the same thing. There's a lot of yuck factors in these cases. Medical insurance plans routinely require various kinds of screenings and take medical histories. What's the difference between those kinds of intake procedures and the screening described? There are two companies, I said this yesterday about smoking and so on. So the same logic, if the screened and unscreened embryos represent significantly higher risk pools, why should the screened pool bear the financial burden of the unscreened pool? If you were a person with a genetic disability, how might you respond to this case study? What's the message to people with disabilities and genetic disorders that it is implied? Does the policy of GenLife amount to a form of eugenics? If so, is that enough for you to know to say that it's wrong? Are there some improvements we could make to our species that would be both desirable and morally justified? Is it possible to counter the you want what's best for your child argument? Is there a theological perspective from which this could be done? Turn and discuss, just in groups of four or five for just 5-6 minutes. Okay, let's see if we can bring attention back to the four or five. Okay. One of the things that you might want to consider is grabbing a table together, you know, at lunch or dinner. I always sit on one or the other ends of the hall there, and if you have an interest in just wanting to talk informally, our table's open to do that. I found it more difficult than usual to stop you from talking in your small groups just because of the intensity and quality of the conversation that was going on in them. I have this ability to kind of selectively hear what's going on. And this case study, you'll notice it's sort of tiered. You've got the first part where you're kind of testing for what we think of as fairly major kinds of genetic disorders. I heard Dr. Hines talk about being significantly damaged somehow. That phrase, significantly damaged. And then moving on to having more control, to moving from what we would think of as diseases and disabilities, disorders, into things like traits, right? And traits that might be prejudicial, you know, in the clip, might provide some advantage, and with the technologies, moving all the way through to then being able to actually insert artificial chromosomes. We saw the chromosomes up there to actually double up on the human growth hormone, perhaps, so you can end up guaranteeing your kid's going to be over 6'3", or 4", or 5", whatever. This one fellow walking around here looks like he's about 6'9", 10". So, you know, it's tiered. And I guess the question, because we're running out of time, I would really like to go to is the question about the perspective of faith, what the perspective of faith has to say about this. And yesterday I spoke about Adrienne Ashe, and is there a place, a perspective of faith that would lead to some kind of acceptance of some genetic testing at the prenatal and perhaps pre-implantation level that would affirm that somehow, but not affirm other kinds of interventions? In other words, down this sort of tiered path towards engineering is pretty much the right term there. Or is it the case that once you start thinking in terms of the appropriateness of doing pre-implantation genetic screening, even if it's for significantly damaged chromosomal anomalies there, have we sort of lost the momentum for the argument at all? So I'd just like to hear what you were talking about in terms of the faith. I'm always tuned into that. So can you share from some of your groups came up with on that?
If you absolutely oppose abortion, the problems all become simpler because you simply decline all interventions because you know that you wouldn't abort anyway. Although you might oppose abortion and still accept repair or insertion in utero that would correct a deficiency. So there you could be quite radical. while still being totally opposed to abortion, you could fix things in utero, as long as you agreed that whether it got fixed or not, you would never abort.
But so you can only fix it if you've defined it as broken.
Yeah.
Well, insofar as we accept medical treatment at all, is there a moral difference between treating a child and an adult and treating a fetus or perhaps even an embryo? You know, is there what would be the moral difference between doing that? In other words, the same question that you asked could also be asked for treatments that we routinely get now. And if there were a treatment for Huntington's, I assume that people would take would change that if they could. And if you can change it as an adult, and you couldn't somehow fix that allele in utero.
But it almost goes back to what you were talking about in yesterday's session about, is it a genetic disease or trait or expression? I mean, I'm colorblind. Is that a genetic disability? Is it a genetic disease? Or is it just something that it's a trait. It's what I am. I can't see red and green. I have a teddy bear. He's called Green Bear. He's brown, but he's Green Bear, because that's what I see him as. It's not a disease.
I think what we try to talk about is well, how do you define what's best for your child or for anybody? You know, what I say is best might be very different than what anybody else says is best.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I see a couple hands in the back. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have a problem with killing a live fetus, but for all the other things, I don't know where. I don't see a moral issue there. There may be a wisdom, a judgment thing, but and there may be undesirable things, but I'm not sure where morality. Well, we have five people in our group, and I think we had about six or seven opinions. But I don't see where there's a moral issue in there.
Yeah, you don't see that there's a moral issue in any of the scenarios, or only in the first, or?
The first
was simply, you know, screening for genetic, what would be, you know, the insurance company at least would define as a disease, and screening for those and doing the process.
If you end up with
an embryo to implant that is free from any of the major inheritable diseases, to use the language of the clip.
I mean, we may be limiting the strength and vitality of diversity, but that to me is just a poor judgment as opposed to an immoral thing.
Yeah. Just a quick note for me, it always pushes the mystery of suffering. You know, I mean, it turns out whether you're a religious person or a person of faith or not, Paul turns out to be roughly right about suffering. You know, it's annoying, I suppose, in a way that we're all old enough in here to understand it. We've all probably gone through stuff that, had we known we were going to, we would have avoided doing it, and perhaps even now would look back on it and say, I wish I hadn't gone through that. But however, we have to somehow end up, I think, all of us understand that somehow all of the things that matter most to us, that we value the most, that we're most passionate about, perhaps even a kind of humility that comes from having been dashed in life in one way or another. You wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. It's almost as though we simultaneously want to avoid suffering and yet know that we can't be what we need to be and want to be and truly value in being without it somehow. So the whole premise of medicine, of eliminating all of these forms of suffering at least, when you have this kind of power and knowledge, raises some fundamental, you know, questions about the role of suffering. Jill, did you?
Yeah, a couple of things. My son is colorblind, which I don't have a problem with, but he also has type 1 diabetes, and we've spent lots of money trying to help him with that, and we would mortgage our house and spend thousands of money if there were a cure or something that would get rid of it for him. And so in with that in mind, you know, this is my only time here, you know, thinking if I had the chance beforehand and had two different options, you know, both could be great children, one would have diabetes, one wouldn't. I'm not sure there is much of a difference between what we're trying to do right now, which is get rid of the diabetes after he's got it, after he's alive, you know, been born, as opposed to getting rid of it beforehand. Either way, we're still trying to get rid of it and change what he has been afflicted with. And even if he had did not have diabetes or any of these other things, if he had, you know, screened free of all those horrible things, he'd have plenty of suffering to deal with during his life, I'm sure. You know, there could be car accidents, there could be, you know, bad relationships. I mean, there's all sorts of other suffering. It's not like you're going to be free of dealing with suffering and the cleansing fire that can provide just because you screen out some of these things that, as a parent, you do what you could to get rid of anyway.
And it does bring us back to Don talking about, we are forced in some ways to return to the debate about abortion, especially as it moves all the way back to conception and embryos, right? And so you're envisioning here two embryos, right? Now, if you forget all the stuff that we were talking about before, which at this point is still fantasy of treating embryos, you know, you've got two embryos. One of them is the sarin, you know. We're good family friends here. It's the sarin, you know, right? And one is, you don't know who that would have been, you know. Now go back and think about that choice. Again, that you might think of that as a kind of a false and misleading or red herring, to use the philosophical term, because in the environment, what I'm asking you to do, you can't do. You just got two embryos there. You don't know that sarin is sarin. But because we can do this imagining, we do begin to think about what a viable human embryo, implantable embryo, means, right? So I'm just curious how that settles into your thinking at all.
That's, the thing is, you don't know at the time, and you can assume that the other embryo, which you just choose not to do, would be just as wonderful a person. Why would I think that this one would be a better person than this person? When they're in that early stage, you can look at them and think that they both have potential to be great people.
Right.
Now, I have to love my son, yes, but, in that early stage, you're choosing one or the other, whether you know them or not, and they could both be great.
Maybe the immorality is to take two embryos, to even say, okay, I'm going to produce two embryos and take my choice. I mean, maybe we should just say, you only take one embryo, although we already are faced with that with in vitro fertilization. So my own daughter had to have a donor egg, and there were produced two embryos, and one of them looked healthier than the other. There were just more cells there. But they implanted both of them. She might have said just one. That would have just been on the basis of not genetic screening, but there was still a choice there. Then you think about the octomom, who had apparently eight healthy embryos and chose to say, okay, I can't choose them. Who knows what was going through her crazy mind, but she said, okay, I'll take them all. I mean, maybe we should have admired that rather than her saying, okay, I'll take this one and this one. But maybe it's setting up choice at the beginning is where we should draw the line.
Yeah, we have to close real quickly here. I was told to not do what we're doing.
One very quick comment is the whole flavor of it implied absolute knowledge.
We can't hear.
I think we don't have absolute knowledge. They don't, we don't. And we don't know. Stephen Hawking's going to come down with MS. Let's not fertilize that embryo. We would have missed out on something very great.
I don't think anyone would argue there. Yeah. That what the argument would come in on what the consequences are, what the implications of that comment is for our moral reasoning about this and theological reasoning about this. Right?
Yeah, we don't know what plan God has for that person.
Right, and then the on the other side, people will then bring up the alternative to Stephen Hawking's idea. If we'd known that this embryo would have been Hitler or something, God, what heroes we would have been in at least God's eyes or the universe's eyes if we had, just not implanted that one somehow. Right? So, but. But even thinking that way implies all kinds of things about the genetic myth, that somehow it's all in the genes, and had you brought that forward, there wouldn't have been a Hitler or a Stephen Hawking. That may be false. It may be that there's all kinds of conditions and all complex interactions that lead to the rise of Hitler's and Stephen Hawking's. Yeah.
I mean, our group was, one of the things that came up is, you know, I haven't heard much about the nature versus nurture debate here. I mean, nurture hasn't been mentioned at all. It's all like genes or everything.
Right. And from when biologists talk about environment, they also include environment within the womb and also even within the blastocyst. So that it turns out that with embryos, you have genetic twins. They aren't truly identical. There are conditions that lead to mutations fairly early on, even in the womb, that lead to some differences. By the way, to try and, you know, wrap your mind around all the questions about ensoulment and so on, there are people that embryos not only can divide, they can also fuse. You understand what I'm saying? You can end up with what would have otherwise been non-identical twins, you know, where you just simply have two inseminations, you have two embryos there, right, that end up fusing. And they only discovered this, they didn't realize it existed, when they began doing genetic testing, and they did it for two parts of the body. Mm-hmm. And you can have a person with two different genomes. One person, two genomes. So if you have this thing about soulment, that it's at conception that the soul takes place, there's something mechanical about that at conception. Mechanical meaning it's sort of automatic at conception. What is no. This? You have one person and two souls, or
why call it a soul? I mean, putting the soul in it.
Just that, you know, if you, yeah, I am from philosophically, I'm a part of a group that we call ourselves non-substance dualists. We don't have having the concept of a soul as some sort of spiritual substance of some kind doesn't solve any problem. All you do is turn all the problems we already have and then ascribe them to a world we don't see. But if you look at that world we don't see and give shape and structure, it ends up it has all the same problems that the material world we live in. So having a concept of a soul that involves substance, I mean, they have these ridiculous experiments of, you know, maybe at the moment of death, you know, they'll lose a little bit of weight and so on because the soul has a. It's not that. But I am a dualist in the sense that we are irreducibly perspectives on the world. And for me, that brings in all of the metaphysics of faith, actually. For me, and it's a long conversation, it brings all the metaphysics of faith back into my life by understanding that that's irreducible. It's an irreducible fact of being of human consciousness. But that's, again, you know, if you want to, we can talk in blind for something.
Yeah,
about this. Okay, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.